tea establishment woke up and smelled the coffee. Mm. This is something which they need to focus on.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time again today. I want to thank our guests, Huda Mori, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. You won't find the corporate media shining a light into the murky corners of the Zionist lobby like we do. And we'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends. And how about contemplation upon words of wisdom as taught to us by Barometer of Faith, Imam Ali, peace upon him. How strange is this man? He becomes happy when he gains that which would never miss him, and becomes sad when he misses that which he would never catch. Had he thought, he would have realized that everything is planned and his earnings are predestined. He would have also sufficed with the available and would not have gone into the hard.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is Zainab, and today we're going to discuss something very important with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi is a faculty member at Al-Mustafa University. Dear listeners, in this program, we try to answer your questions and issues that you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified progeny. Assalamu alaikum, Professor.
Alaikum salam.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
I want to convey you another salam from one of my friends who actually listened to one of our conversations and was very, very thankful towards you, because she has been, after a question, she has been looking for an answer for a long time, and after listening to a conversation, she actually concluded something. She said to me that she has found an answer, and she told me to convey salam and thank you to you. One of the things that she said I would like to discuss was that she has restricted her husband. She does not let him go into the gatherings or into the meetings or wherever there's a gathering, because she feels that her husband gets overexcited. And according to her husband, since his childhood, he has been living or upbrought in a very restricted environment. Then the episode that she listened to was management of emotions in teens. And she said that after listening to this conversation, she got to the point that why his husband gets overexcited or why he cannot control himself when he's in a gathering and she has to restrict him for that is that he has not been taught management of emotions in his teens. So she was very thankful to you, and she kind of got the answer where the thing is missing. So I wanted to convey that to you. Well,
thank you.
Even if a person realizes this very late, is there any solution for that?
Of course. I mean, the room for repenting is always there till we live, though it becomes difficult after a certain age, especially 40 is considered to be an age where things settle in, when your habits have been formed and solidified, and it's very difficult to change. But that's not the case. The human being is so adaptable, is so... God Almighty has given him, the human being, so much of these internal powers and strengths which can make a person change even at a very later age. I remember my late father, after his 70s, he was a changed person as far as his dealings with our mother would go, and so many other things. So it's possible.
As the experience comes in.
Exactly. The more one person wants to become, really understands and wants to become close to God Almighty and wants to realize his position in society, in not just society or in this household or in the family, generally in the scheme of creations, where does mankind stand? What is the responsibility of mankind? And especially when he has been undergoes so many difficulties in life, and he realizes that many of these difficulties which he has faced, the difficult situation he has faced with his in his family, with his spouse, with his children, one of the causes might be himself. He or she is the cause of those problems.
Yeah.
Till one time that one does not realize that he is the cause or she is the cause of these problems that he or she is facing.
Yeah.
But a time that comes and it dawns upon him or her that, look, I have to change myself. And if I want to change others, I need to change myself. If I want people to behave with me in a better way, in a different way,
I have to behave.
So I have to control my emotions. I have to control. And especially when it becomes of an old age, many of those things, those ambitions which were there, in the things which would excite us at a very early age, maybe in the teens or even 20s, 30s, 40s, now that is not there. A human being, when he reaches a higher stage, middle age or beyond that, he's not so ambitious. He does not look. So he can manage himself quite easily.
Yeah. Professor, we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqafi. And we have been discussing about the issue that if one does not manage his emotions in his teens, later in his life, it may reflect in one or the other way. Well, Professor, in this case that we discussed before the break, the thing was that this child, her husband, was actually restricted as a child so much that when he became an adult, he started getting overexcited, getting into the gatherings or like seeing women. So do you think extreme restriction is bad?
For sure. I mean, again, that's the balance between freedom and dignity. If we are going to curtail the freedom of a person, or we are going to give him excessive freedom, either both of these ways. Things, both ways, it's going to damage and jeopardize dignity.
Yeah.
If he becomes over freedom, if a child wants to have his own way or her way all the time and wants everyone to fall in line, that's excessive freedom. So again, he or she is going to damage and jeopardize the dignity that a human being has, because the dignity of the human being is not his own dignity. It's the dignity of the other person also. The other person is also a human being.
Indeed.
His or her dignity has to be respected. So if a person always wants to have his own way and doesn't leave any room for others, then he's not even respecting his own humanity.
Indeed.
So humanity as a whole has to be
respected.
Whether it's my human being, a human being, or the other person, my sibling or my parents or whoever, or my workmate or my classmate. So human dignity is not just respecting oneself, it's respecting others also. So if I'm going to have my own way or excessive freedom, or if I'm not allowed to have freedom, completely I'm restricted by my parents and I'm not able to do anything, I cannot become independent. Tomorrow I will not be able to make the proper decisions. I will not be able to make my own, I will not be able to manage my own affairs, even my family. I will always be looking towards my parents to come in and help him.
Because one of the important things that you have discussed with us, for teens what was important was management of emotions. And management comes when you actually go out in the society, when you actually face everything. But when you're not letting your teen face all that, you're actually restricting him to the extent now, tomorrow after getting married, he's not able to control himself. Exactly. He's not able to control his thoughts and have a management of his emotions. So you're saying that both, it's not just parents have failed to teach their teen the management of emotions. It's basically the extreme restrictness they have put on, feeling that this is the best form of upbringing, has actually led him into the problems in his future life.
Exactly. So,
well, we'll discuss.
He needs to control his emotions, manage his emotions. Excessiveness in both ways is not allowed. He should be managed in such a way, he should be taught in such a way that he is capable of maintaining a balance.
Yes. We'll talk more on the topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqafi. This is IRIB English Radio. And we're talking about a case wherein a female said that her husband gets overexcited whenever he's in the gatherings, and she restricts him just of the fear that he looks at someone or gets overexcited or is not able to manage his emotions. And she, listening to our program, reached the conclusion that this has happened because the management of emotions has not taken place in his teens. And now in our program, we have discussed that restriction, extreme restriction in his teens is also one of the factors that has not let him go out in the society, face and confront other gender, and actually then manage his emotions. Well, Professor, what is your message for such parents?
Initially, if it's the issue about, let's talk about this lady herself. If she's in a situation where she finds that her husband is allured or excited by looking at the opposite sex, now she needs to prevent that. She cannot force that again. She needs to...
So now, again, restricting him is another problem.
Is another problem. She should become such that he is excited by her.
So the change needs to be begin at home.
Begin at home. He should be, an environment should be created where he is satisfied, where his feelings and emotions are channelized, and that he is able to express himself. He is able to, the energy which is being put is there in him is thrown at his wife. The wife should be behaving in such a way that he should be attracted to her only. If she wants him to be only his property, of
again,
course,
restriction is not a solution.
That again is problematic. You can't, a lady cannot expect her husband to be exclusively for her, especially when she's not taking care of herself. Because the basic priority, the basic responsibility of the woman, of the wife, is to take care of the emotional, especially the sexual needs of the human man. So this has to be taken care of. If it's not taken care of, whatever restriction is put on her will
make things worse.
And the same thing, of course, it happens to children. How do they take care of their children? Of course, again, stimuli that create such stimulation and excitement should be avoided for children. Somehow they should be given other rooms and alternatives to express their feelings, their emotions, playing, other events, reading books, stories, whatever, which does not create a stimulation for their feelings, especially their sexual feelings. And if a teen has got into such a situation where it is becoming a difficult situation, difficult thing for him or her, then there should be a way out. By suppressing that, there's no other alternative other than marriage. So either don't let that happen, don't let that stage be reached, especially for a teen.
Yeah.
Or then provide him a solution which is allowed religiously.
So we are actually getting to know here that there is no place of suppression or restriction in Islam, be that in upbringing or be that in marriage. So what actually, even this lady, what is this? Last answer for her from our side is there. She has to be a very good emotional support to actually fulfill all those gaps led that have been there since the upbringing was not proper. Thank you so much, Professor, for helping us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. And in case you want to listen to our episodes again, please go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. In case you want to listen to our episodes on social media, you can also surf there by just searching Call of Islam. And in case you have any questions, please do feel free to email us on our email ID, which is englishradio@irib.ir. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Revolution of 79. Part 1.
that the Americans didn't learn about it.
Because there was an unwritten...
The Shahs...
That also talked for a number of people.
I think one of the most...
August 19th, 1953. Iranian history took a critical turn as Mohammad Mossadegh, Iran's democratically elected prime minister, was overthrown in a coup orchestrated by Anglo-American agents. The coup paved the way for Mohammad Reza Shah to rule the country with an iron fist for a quarter of a century. Years later, the Anglo-American chickens came home to roost when the anti-American sentiment brought down the curtain on the reign of the US-backed Shah under the leadership of Ayatollah Khomeini. At the end of the year 1976, and just a few days before US presidential elections, Mohammad Reza Shah pointed out in a press interview that Iran controls a significant part of the free world's energy resources, and the free world cannot stand the loss of Iran.
Before the oil crisis, you all know that we had the monetary crisis. We were not responsible for the monetary crisis of the world. That was before the increase in the price of oil. If some economies are sick, is not our fault. But nevertheless, we would be glad to help some economies which are not doing so well, and we are doing that.
He supplied oil to Israel. He was anti-Soviet. He provided security in the Gulf. He was, when we wanted to make trouble with Iraq, he gladly participated. So we got a lot for our tolerance of his regime during that period.
Our biggest disagreement was about oil. The United States wanted the price of oil to be low, and he wanted it to be high. And I think Kissinger was not very, he was thinking about the strategic aspects and not so much about the economic aspects of the situation. Later, it's actually the reverse of that, because if you get to mid-70s, when, in fact, just before the revolution started, the United States was actually very interested in lowering the price of oil because it was hurting the political chances of President Ford, for example. He realized that with the price of oil going up the way it was going to make it very difficult for him to get elected.
When I went to Iran, my job was to deal with the military program for the State Department. The price of oil soon quadrupled, at least, with late 1973. And Richard Nixon had told the Shah that he could buy whatever he wanted in military hardware, excluding nuclear weapons. And so the Shah had plenty of money to do that. So I had a very busy plate, a lot of things going on.
Thank you, President Ford, and thank you, Governor Carter, for being with us tonight. This debate takes
during the run-up to U.S. presidential elections, the Shah of Iran pulled for Ford and supported him financially.
People were out of work. People were unhappy with the economic situation. They had been expecting the curve of the prosperity to go up and up, and instead it turned and it started going down. And when that happens, people tend to react very strongly. And so that was one of the additional aspects of the revolution. Clearly, this was all done under Ford and Kissinger, actually, when Kissinger was Secretary of State and Ford was the president. And that during that period, in fact, was when the United States actually conspired to bring the prices down. And it actually may have harmed the Shah very severely.
We weren't happy with the price hike, but there was nothing we could do about it. He wanted that income, And it fit with Nixon and Kissinger's plan that we were able to get some of that money in return by our arms sales and our participation in development projects. We did much better with higher oil prices than the Europeans did, or Asian countries.
There were no bones of contention between the U.S. and the Shah of Iran before the argument over the price of oil. The United States was going to keep Iran within the global alliance system, and the Shah of Iran could rest easy as long as he had the U.S. by his side.
The single group that really wants Iran and the U.S. to come to some sort of understanding has been the oil companies. And so it was oil companies that were helping to fund citizen-citizen contacts, all sorts of third-party or second-channel backdoor negotiations, cultural engagement and displays of Iranian art that would come to American museums, because they wanted better relations. They wanted to break into the Iranian market. They wanted to have fewer limitations on their dealings with the Iranian oil industry.
Remember, it's important to realize that Carter ran on a foreign policy platform which had two elements. One is no arms sales to dictators, and two, human rights internationally. Well, it turns out that the Shah of Iran was the largest purchaser of American arms. So when Carter is talking about no arms sales to dictators, who the hell could he be talking about? And number two, international human rights, that was the time when huge numbers of organizations were protesting human rights violations in Iran. So the Shah of Iran heard this and said, that's me. This guy is talking about me. He's not talking about the King of Saudi Arabia. He's not talking about Ferdinand Marcos. He's talking about me. And so I thought I was in good with these Americans, and all of a sudden, this guy becomes president of the United States, and that's his deal with foreign policy. So now I'm really nervous.
As soon as Jimmy Carter took office, he expressed his willingness to meet with the Shah. In a meeting with President Carter, Ardashir Zahedi, Iranian ambassador to Washington, said the ties between Iran and the U.S. have never been so close and strong.
Iran was central to U.S. foreign policy globally. Iran and the Shah in particular were trusted as being staunch allies and force multipliers for the United States in a region that was considered to be both a bulwark in the fight against communism in the Cold War and a site of, obviously, huge tensions and conflict in its own right in the Middle East.
According to the National Census conducted in 1976, Iran had a population of about 33.5 million that year. A young country which the U.S. counted on for the stability of the Persian Gulf region, Iran was also a major oil supplier of Israel.
As the question of oil, oil goes everywhere. When a tanker is filled up, you really don't know the destination of it. It could go, as I said, to everywhere, and as well to Israel.
The Iranian point for Israel was very important because it was a major pillar of its strategic conception. Then there was the issue of oil. Iran was a major oil supplier, of course, to Israel. There are other things they're doing together. So once the Shah fell, it required a major assessment of Israel's strategic position. And the same applied to the United States. I mean, the Shah was America's major ally in the Middle East for a very long time, and definitely since the late 60s when oil revenues started accumulating and Iran became an important player under Nixon. Iran became basically the predominant power there in the Nixon doctrine. He thought Iran could promote American interests in the Gulf. And afterwards, Iran was a major purchaser of American weapons. You had tens of thousands of Americans working in Iran. So Iran was basically the major pillar.
The first sign of disagreement between the Shah and the Carter administration popped up as the U.S. refused to sell aircraft to Iran by canceling the AWACS contract. In an interview with Business Week, the Shah said, Iran has a capacity to become a $10 billion market per annum for
for the U.S. artillery products. And if the U.S. refuses to sell arms to Iran, it will lose that opportunity.
And if there is any sharing of resources, well, then we can share many things with the United States.
As the news over the tension between Iran and the U.S. broke, the media in both countries began to adopt new attitudes towards each other. Meanwhile, the island of stability was undergoing massive changes in its underneath layers.
I don't want to go into details about these things because I have already expressed myself. It is impossible to get anywhere on dictation terms. We are still ready to discuss, as always, all these problems, but the solution of these problems cannot be one-sided, and that once again in the favor of the rich countries of the world.
On January 21st, 1977, Mahmoud Jafarian, the head of Rastakhiz, or Resurrection Party, said, "Imperialism is intertwined with Iranian blood, race, and culture." 2 years later, when Iran was plunged in revolution, Parviz Adl, the foreign ministry spokesman, called Iranians Shah worshippers. He also advised the Iranian people to keep the peace. The country was to be thrown into political turmoil, but the regime was not in the picture.
Unrest during the Shah's regime focused on a number of broad factors. I mean, first and foremost, the Shah was a dictator. There was not really any sharing of power after the Mossadegh era with anybody else. The Shah kept all power for himself. Any trappings of democracy that existed, like elections or political parties or anything, or independent newspapers, were just a sham. Iran was a dictatorship under the Shah. It was not highly repressive until the 1970s. I would say it was more like moderately repressive in the 50s and 60s. In the 1970s, it became highly repressive.
On February 3rd, 1977, 66 political prisoners were released from Qasr prison. All of them denied being tortured when in detention. This was part of their freedom deal. Ali Akbar Etemad, the head of Iran's nuclear energy organization, announced plans for constructing 20 nuclear power plants in the country with the help of foreign companies. And on June 4, 1977, it was announced that the world's largest nuclear reactor would be built in Bushehr in 4 years' time. Iran was clearing the decks for joining the International Nuclear Club. And on July 5, 1977, Iranian Prime Minister Amir Abbas Hoveidar declared, "The government cherishes freedom of expression and believes firmly in a diversity of opinions." The statement heralded seismic changes in the regime's behavior to come in line with Carter's human rights policy. On August 6, 1977, Hoveidar stepped down from his post as Prime Minister to be succeeded by Jamshid Amuzgar. At the same time, Asadullah Alam handed in his resignation as Minister of Royal Court. Cancer had nearly struck him down. These fundamental changes in the structure of the regime left the Shah high and dry, especially in making decisions. The revolution was moving towards a climax. On August 13th, Dariush Humayun, former Minister of Information and Tourism, said no one should fear to voice criticism. After all, he had been arrested and imprisoned on the Shah's orders during the period of adjustment in 1977.
Criticism was out of question. The Shah became megalomaniac in every field, including foreign policy.
Would you feel this personally when you would interact with him?
Well, you could see it in his body language, in his speeches, interviews with Americans. Some of his late interviews with Americans are really damaging to. Were really damaging to him.
By mid-1977, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi had branded all his opponents as a bunch of terrorists. Talking to Kehan newspaper on September 11, 1977, the Shah said, "We ask those who cry for freedom just one question. What kind of freedom do you want?" In September 1977, Ayatollah Talavani's lawyers objected to his 10-year imprisonment. 3 years before, the Shah had announced in an interview that in his country, only communists were prosecuted. It was there that he coined the term Islamic Marxism. Meanwhile, the Shah was diagnosed with cancer and had to undergo intensive treatment. His ill health had cast a gloom over his future. Ruling the country had been a bumpy ride for the Shah. Poor health and weakness of character had made the situation even worse. He also had a recurring nightmare of losing the US support. On the other hand, the gap between social classes was widening as never before. The country was on the brink of a great revolution. Suddenly, the price of oil began to soar. It was 1 minute to midnight for the crestfallen Shah to keep the throne for a longer time. By the end of 1977, Iran's oil exports exceeded 5.2 million barrels per day. And thanks to the windfall oil revenues, the country could import goods from 129 countries around the world.
You see, the oil is a very complicated business. We sell it to the oil companies. Now, there are so many different prices. A posted price, a realized price, a halfway price, a back-buy price, God knows what else. Then they are making these profits in addition to this. Well, I'm not criticizing, this is the sovereign right of each country, but I know some countries who levy taxes which are higher than we oil producing countries get by selling one barrel of oil.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Almighty. Dear brothers and sisters, salam. And welcome to this episode of today's special. Dear brothers and sisters, on this episode of today's special, we're going to speak about Islamic Revolution and its achievements. Be with us. Today, Tuesday, is the 16th of Rajab, 1444 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 18th of Bahman, 1401 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 5th of February, 2023 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. At this time, that is the beginning moments of today's special, we listen to chapter Al-Ma'idah, verse 3 of the Holy Quran.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم حرمت عليكم الميتة والدم ولحم الخنزير وما أهل لغير الله به والمنخنقة والمنخنقة والموقوذة والمتردية والنطيحة وما أكل السبع إلا ما ذكيتم وما ذبح على النصب وأن تستقسموا بالأزلام ذلكم فسق اليوم يئس الذين كفروا من دينكم فلا تخشوهم واخشون اليوم أكملت لكم دينكم وأتممت عليكم نعمتي ورضيت لكم الإسلام دينا فمن اضطر في مخمصة غير متجانف لإثم فإن الله غفور رحيم.
Prohibited to you are dead animals, blood, the flesh of swine, and that which has been dedicated to other than Allah, and those animals killed by strangling, or by a violent blow, or by a headlong fall, or by the goring of horns, and those from which a wild animal has eaten, except what you are able to slaughter before its death, and those which are sacrificed on stone altars. And prohibited is that you seek decision through divining arrows. That is grave disobedience. This day those who disbelieve have despaired of defeating your religion. So fear them not, but fear me. This day I have perfected for you your religion, and completed my favor upon you, and have approved for you Islam as religion. But whoever is forced by severe hunger with no inclination to sin, then indeed Allah is forgiving and merciful.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The firmness of the religious school depends on a correct leadership, so with its existence all the infidels became hopeless at that time. If the leader of the day of Qadir and Wilaya exists in the society, Muslims must not have any fear. The most important window of the hope of infidels was the departure of the Muslims' leaders. By the assignment of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib for the leadership, that window was closed. However, the religion without having a leader is not complete.
IRIB English Radio in the month of Bahman presents
today's special.
The topic of this part is Islamic Revolution and its achievement. Iran's progress in science and technology since 1979 has shocked Western observers, many of whom falsely imagined that an Islamically based society would be run by obscurantists. In reality, Iran's religious establishment trained in a formidable system of seminaries, maybe the most highly educated group of national Platonic guardians in the world. In fact, Islamic Iran may be the only country left on earth ruled by people who revere classical education, so it really shouldn't surprise anyone that Iran's university system has prospered since 1979, that educational level, especially among women, have risen sharply, and Iranian scientists have achieved breakthroughs enabling their country to forge ahead economically and technologically despite the never-ending regime of draconian sanctions.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. This is Ali, and we are going to talk about the Islamic revolution in Iran and its achievements for more than four decades. On the eve of the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic revolution, the outcome of Iran's uprising against the US-backed rule of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi is a hot topic of discussion among Iranians. We're going to talk about the achievements and successes of the revolution in the past four decades in various sectors. One of the important principles in the Islamic Republic is the concept of Vilayatul Faqih, which pertains to the leadership of the system. This leader enjoys certain criteria and specifications. The Islamic Republic of Iran's constitution has mentioned the characteristics of Vilayatul Faqih, that is, supreme jurisprudence. They are piety, justice, courage, management, prudence, awareness of domestic and foreign political issues, and mastery of Islamic sciences. Waliul Faqih, that is the leader of, as the leader of the Islamic Revolution, is appointed by the assembly of experts who are in turn elected by the people's votes. The four-decade experience of the Islamic Republic clearly shows that the leader plays the prime role in preservation of the system, the rights of the people, and resolving the internal and external problems. After the concept of Vilayatul Faqih, I can refer to the concept of freedom and the great freedom that people are favored with. The Islamic Revolution granted the Iranian nation freedom in various fields. The Iranian nation had been suppressed for centuries, especially during the Pahlavi regime, and its dissent would be quenched and opponents would be jailed, tortured and murdered. In the Islamic Republic of Iran, people are free to hold legal gatherings and meetings and express their opinion in various matters. They elect the officials of the country, including the president, members of the parliament and city councils. They also elect the members of the assembly of the experts who appoint the leader. Through more than four decades of the Islamic Republic, more than 40 elections have been held, including three referendums, more than 13 presidential elections, and 11 parliamentary elections, five or six assembly of experts, and also the elections for city and village councils, and the election for the constitution.
In the month of Bahman, the month of Islamic Revolution, be with today's special.
In this episode of today's special, we look at the achievements of the Islamic Revolution in the field of health and wellness. About Life Expectancy Index, according to the United Nations Development Program from 1960 to 1979, the life expectancy index at birth increased from 49.5 years in the initial year to 51.5 years in the final year. In other words, life expectancy among Iranians on the eve of the victory of the Islamic Revolution has been among the lowest in the world. While after the victory of the revolution, although we were involved in the war for 8 years, but life expectancy in Iran in 1988 has reached 61.5 years. That is in the first 10 years after the victory of the revolution, 10 years of the life expectancy for Iranians has increased. The World Bank report shows that the life expectancy of the Iranian people has increased for 22 years since the beginning of the revolution. World Bank statistics show that in 1976, the average Iranian population lived only 55 years, which increased to 76.2 years.
The explosion of light in the modern age of ignorance with the support of Islam. The Islamic Revolution.
Iran Islamic Revolution, achievements of four decades, Velayat-e-Faqih. An important principle in the Islamic Republic is Velayat-e-Faqih, which pertains to the leadership of the system. This leader enjoys certain criteria and specifications. The Islamic Republic of Iran's constitution has mentioned the characteristics of Velayat-e-Faqih and or supreme jurisprudent. They are piety, justice, courage, management, prudence, awareness of domestic and foreign political issues, and mastery of the Islamic sciences. Veli-e-Faqih, as the leader of the Islamic Revolution, is appointed by the Assembly of Experts who are in turn elected by the people's votes. The four decades' experience of the Islamic Republic clearly shows that the leader plays the prime role in the preservation of the system, the rights of the people, and resolving the internal and external problems.
Imam al-Khomeini, when he looks at human beings, at the humanity, he looks at them as people who have been created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as well. And that is why he has utmost respect and dignity for human communities, for all human beings, whether irrespective of their religion, of their faith, of their ethnicity, of their culture, of their race. Why? Because he knew that all of us, we are created, we have only one aim, to serve Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He was in Paris in 1978, before the 25th of December, before Christmas approached. Imam Rahmatullah alayhi, he calls one of his advisors and he tells her that I have been here in this town and many people have been coming to see me, and this might have caused inconvenience to many people, to my neighbors. So he tells her that you prepare some gifts and presents, and on the Christmas Eve you go and deliver these presents to these neighbors. And on my behalf, apologize to them that if they should forgive me if I have caused any inconvenience to them. He was the leader of a political movement, but see to what extent he is showing his respect to human beings, irrespective of their faith, irrespective of their religion.
Dear brothers and sisters, thank you very much for joining us. That is the end of this episode of today's special. We leave you in Allah's blessings. Fi amanillah.
Ah! We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.